The truth is that he knows a little about something and never hesitates to say a great deal about everything. His friends and admirers naturally consider him a perfect oracle, and pause upon his every word. I believe that is the expression. He is always ready with pontifical declarations upon every subject on earth. Sooner or later a subject not on earth is bound to crop up. Somebody will ask him if he believes in a hereafter, and if so, what manner of place does he think it to be? That is the moment when the trouble begins. The great philosopher, and there are many whose title is accorded them upon the flimsiest grounds, knows nothing about the matter whatever, but that is no hindrance, and so he refers to literature dealing with a subject which he has never read, but has only heard about very sketchily. One of his most fatuous utterances is embodied in the question I put to you a moment ago, that the spirit world is a dreary imitation of the earth, which in his estimation, is a vastly superior place in which to live. Another objection which he raises concerns the quality and substance of the spiritual teachings that are sent to the earth from time to time. Do you remember that scriptural text, Roger, about loving one another? Good sound stuff that, eh? Oh, yes. I heard sermons on the text, sometimes, when went to church. Which, I believe, was not very often. I'm referring to the church going, not to the sermons on the text. Roger and Ruth both laughed. I wit and humor may not be of a high, scintillating order, but then, it isn't meant to be. Among ourselves we utter the same kind of pleasantries such as would be, and are, customary among friends in their own domestic circles on earth. And, I would have you know, we like to have our domestic circles here in these lands of the spirit world. We prefer to retain our mild jokes, however small they may be judged to be. Humor is the essence of this life. We take pleasure in making our friends and companions smile, as we ourselves are pleasured at their allies. In other words, we are human, despite earthly ideas to the contrary. Doubtless much of what I am here setting down for you will be regarded as trivial rubbish. At least there is this to be said for it: it is not nearly as trivial or such rubbish as most the grandiose utterances of earthly philosophers when they give their opinions of the spirit world and of us who live in it. What those same gentry think about affairs when they themselves come to live here, is another thing altogether. Now, Roger, when you heard those sermons on brother love, you thought it was good sound teaching, and beyond dispute, didn't you?
Yes, certainly.
And you were right. The original precept came from a man who knew what he was talking about. And our great philosopher would have been in complete agreement with the preacher in this case, that brotherly love is essential, and so on. It is essential, and spirit teachers have harped upon that theme, time out of mind, and they will continue to do so, as long as there is an earth world to speak to. But what does you suppose is the comment upon such spirit world teachings when considered by at least one of these renowned philosophic gentlemen? I've no notion. It's this: frowsy religious uplift. Elegant, isn't it? Can't you observe the stupendous mind at work? The parson preaches brotherly love to him from his pulpit, and he is suitably impressed and in full agreement. The spirit teacher tells him about it, and it becomes frowsy uplift. Monsignor feels rather keenly on the subject, Roger, observed Ruth, as we all do here, because sooner or later one of these gentlemen is bound to come our way, and that means hard work, and very tedious work for whoever is deputed to look after him. You see, Roger, the trouble is not alone with these gentry themselves. Their pernicious views are read and absorbed by their rather tattered following, and treated as profound truths, so that if nothing intervenes in the meantime to make them alter their opinions, there will be others arriving here in a similar state of ignorance. In other words, said Roger, the mistakes of the earth have to be put right here. That's exactly it. In your own case, it was an absolute holiday for Ruth and me. What so complicates individual instances is where the new arrival knows nothing about this life, but has wrong ideas about it. You knew nothing, and fortunately had no ideas at all. I don't say that in derogation, you know that, my dear fellow. What you did have was a dear mind, free of all silly notions, even to the extent of harps and wings.
One of the most senseless charges brought by these learned gentry is that all the communicators from the spirit world are English, so that, in effect, the spirit world is wholly English, to the total exclusion of all other nations. People of other countries might say the same.
Exactly. The Frenchman, for instance, might say that the whole spirit world seems to be French because in France all the spirit communicators are French. The very same thing could be said throughout the whole Earth world. Can you imagine what would happen if a company of these highly intelligent and skeptical philosophers were to meet, one from every nation? They would each be in somewhat of a difficulty, for each would wish to establish his country's claims upon patriotic grounds, so to speak, but at the same time would lodge the complaint that the spirit world seemed to belong to his country alone. The proceedings would possibly have that familiar appearance to be observed in international conferences for the preservation of peace. I suppose people of other nations die in the same way that we have done.
You suppose very rightly, my boy. A statement of the obvious, but not so obvious that our philosophic sages are able to perceive it.
Is this part of the spirit world English, then?
What would you think purely from appearances?
I should say, subject to the differences between this world and the earth, that there is a most decided leaning towards the old home landscape.
There is, and the houses bear a resemblance as well. We have not travelled very far afield as yet. So far you've not seen hills of any great height, nor have you seen mountains. But they are here.
As to the people, whom have you met so far?
Well, there's Ruth and yourself, and you have spoken of Edwin. All three of us English like yourself.
Then there is Radiant Wing, and Omar and his friend.
Exactly.
The first, an American Indian, the second, Indian, and the third, Egyptian.
That's almost international in itself.
You left out our cottage friend.
He's another Englishman.
The question is, among what nation did you or would you expect to find yourself after leaving the earth?
Why, it has never occurred to me.
Among English people, I suppose.
Do you speak any other languages than your own?
Not one.
A smattering of school Latin, perhaps.
It would have been decidedly awkward for you if you had awakened to find yourself among the Chinese, for instance.
Probably scared the life out of me,
dear me,
why?
The Chinese are delightful people, kind and thoughtful, and always ready to help.
You see, my dear fellow, that what you say points the stupidity of these philosopher gentlemen in their false notions that the spirit world must be an exclusively English one.
There isn't one of them who would not feel much the same about it as you have this minute described.
Ruth and I have met some of them, and they were profoundly glad to hear their own tongue.
The English tongue, spoken in the same way as we spoke to you.
And the same thing applies to the Frenchman, and the Chinaman, and all the rest.
As you know, personal communication by the thought process obviates any difficulty in the language question.
That process is without nationality.
But when folks are awakening in these lands, they use their vocal organs, and so do we.
That's natural.
What were your own impressions when you opened your eyes in our room beside the open window?
Well, I certainly had an at-home sort of feeling.
The room was the kind I was familiar with, and the view through the window was most certainly familiar too.
Precisely.
That's as it should be.
So you see, there's law and reason behind all this, and nothing that the wise folk of the earth can say or think will alter it.
Then the other nations must be living somewhere else. That's a foolish thing to say.
Of course they must.
They are, Roger.
Every nation on earth had some position and location in the spirit world.
People like to be among their own kind, and there's no reason why they should not be.
Would it be right, do you think, or good policy, to force people of one particular nation or national temperament upon that of another?
Not at first, at any rate.
Then, as to the country itself.
Nations prefer their own type of country, however delightful that of others may be.
Here, they can find it.
And that's right and natural too.
What about Omar and his friend?
Ah, they come into another category.
Where they live, nations have no significance, for the people themselves are above or beyond nationality.
Radiant Wing is just such another.
In the realm proper to him, he loses his precise nationality, though not his racial individuality,
if you understand what I mean.
I'm afraid I don't.
That's not your fault, it's mine. What I mean is that Radiant Wing will retain his particular cast of features, in the same way as Omar will, but that the nation of which he was a former member will have no significance for him, to the extent that Radiant Wing and Omar regard themselves as of no nation and of all nations, as it were. There's no end to the objections which these philosophic geniuses raise upon one matter or another. I noticed that Omar and his friend both spoke English, and without a trace of accent too. That is one of the objections I referred to. Can you think of any reason at all why Omar shouldn't speak English, or any other language?
None whatever, if he wishes to.
If he wishes to.
There you have it, Roger.
If his particular work would be made easier, or indeed, made possible, by his doing so, then do it he will. As it happens, Omar has friends on Earth, mutual friends, as a matter of fact. It became necessary for him to speak with those friends. At first he spoke no English, and they certainly knew no word of Chaldean. What was to be done? It was obvious from the outset that they couldn't learn Chaldean, but it was equally obvious that he could, with the greatest facility, learn the English language. He did so without the slightest inconvenience to himself.
You know what the memory can do here, Roger. Once something goes into the mind, there it stays.
Why, Omar could learn any language well, so as to speak it fluently, while the Earth folk were thinking about it. You will recall that Radiant Wing knows sufficient of our native tongue to make himself comfortably understood for the purpose of his work on Earth. Omar also wanted to make himself understood, but in a different way, and more extensively. He wished to cover a wide range of matters as lucidly as possible, and so he went deeply into the task of learning English. The very same thing applies to us all here. If you, my boy, wish to learn any language, whether to use it actively, I mean, conversationally as well as to read literature in that language, there is no power that can stop you. You are at liberty to begin this moment.
Thousands of us don't, though, because there is no reason for us to do so.
You know, Roger, the higher you go up the spiritual ladder, the less you think about nationality and language, as such, unless there is work to be done on Earth that involves the use of another tongue than your own. How does one get to another country here?
In several ways.
Shanks Mare is one of them.
Monsignor, what's this? How can you reprove Roger for using slang, when you use almost as bad yourself?
Exclaimed Ruth laughing. You see, Roger, what a thoroughly bad influence you are. Here have I been carefully picking my way through the language so as not to use a single word or term that would be frowned upon by those folk on Earth who think we should speak as though we were addressing an ecumenical council or something equally boring.
Ah, well. Evil communications corrupt good manners, I suppose.
There is no difficulty in getting to other countries in these realms, or to be more exact, to those parts where folk from other Earth lands have their dwellings. You were thinking of frontiers mostly, weren't you?
There are no frontiers.
You may come and go as you please, and what's more, you will be as welcome there as the inhabitants of those parts are welcome here. In fact, if you wander along you would hardly perceive you were there, except for some slight difference in the landscape perhaps, and in the dwelling houses. There is only one kind of barrier you will come across in this world, and that is the barrier between one realm and another, and that's invisible, or practically so. An increase or diminution of the light, as the case may be. If there were not that, certain unpleasant, extremely unpleasant, elements would be tempted to overrun the regions next above them. And perhaps some of us would be tempted to develop ideas above our station, as the phrase used to be. It is a natural law that works in this way, and like all such laws it works without any breakdown, fuss, or trouble. That's the beauty of it, no question of difference of opinion, or insistence upon rights. There's no arguing with a natural law. I've yet to hear of anyone arguing with the law of gravity on Earth. It would be a one-sided argument in any case, and probably end in disaster. As far as at least these particular realms are concerned, you might call them cosmopolis with every justification, for you will meet people of every nationality under the sun here, some of them coming and going, and some staying. I can understand the coming and going, but how staying? Roger asked. The best way to answer that is to give you a practical demonstration, though you've had one already, without knowing it.
Have I?
Yes, our old friend Radiant Wing. Doesn't he belong here, then?
Not by any means.
This is rather puzzling.
Shocking.
Monsignor is a terrible torment to you, Roger. Don't take any notice of him.
I know what he means.
Come along and we'll take you on another visit.
That's right.
A visit that would be worth a fortune if it could be made on Earth.
With which cryptic utterance we took our young companion upon a social call at some distance from our home.
13. A house in the forest. Now, Monsignor, will you please explain to me, in simple words if you wish, what you meant by some staying, when you spoke of people of other nationalities?
That's right, Roger, said Ruth, be firm.
Of course, my dear fellow.
There's no mystery.
What meant was that it is sometimes the case that people dwell in certain realms here, when, by virtue of spiritual progression, they are entitled to live in a higher one.
Then why do they stay here?
Because, Roger, there may be very sound reasons for the staying. Some may elect to abide here for purely private reasons, reasons of affection between two individuals. It may transpire that two people, between whom there is a strong bond, might belong to different planes of progression, and therefore inhabit different realms. In such cases it is not uncommon for the one entitled to live in the higher realm remain with the one who has not yet advanced, until such time as the latter has progressed, and then, together, the two mount to their new realm, and so continue unrepeated.
That's one instance. There's another, and I believe more common one, and that is where a certain occupation keeps people so absorbed they prefer to work in the less high realm.
Our friend Radiant Wing is such a case. They are working for humanity still incarnate, Roger, and although they spend a great deal of time here in these regions, yet they constantly travel to their own homes in the higher realms, and so they are residents of both realms. They're leading double lives.
Doesn't that sound too awful for words, exclaimed Ruth.
Doesn't it? And thousands of folk on Earth are leading double lives too, if it comes to that. Their waking time spent on Earth, and their sleeping time spent in the spirit world. There's a grand meeting of friends and relatives that way, Roger. But that's another story. We had already covered some distance when we reached a part of the country that was well wooded, and we entered a very pleasant pine forest. At length we came upon a clearing, and before us was a most attractive house, of no great height, but broad, as though several bungalows had been placed together to form the one structure. There were several large masses of banked flowers to be seen, but no attempt had been made to lay out the grounds surrounding the house into anything like formal gardens. There was an element of wildness about the place, without, however, any suggestion of disorderliness. To the beholder it seemed to betoken a haven of rest and quiet, though this was not in any sense exceptional, since it is impossible to attain absolute rest and quiet even in the heart of the city without the slightest difficulty. Ruth and I had visited this house upon many occasions, but it was new to Roger, and so, in respect thereof, our host was waiting for us at his house door.
Well, my dear Monsignor, and Ruth, too, said he, you've come at the right moment, for I've something for you at least, for Ruth.
We introduced Roger, and briefly explained our proceedings and mission. There was an exchange of warm greeting between our friend and Roger, and we were at once invited within doors.
Call our friend Peter Litch, I whispered to Roger, and look for surprises.
One of them was not long in presenting itself. We were shown into a spacious apartment that was both sitting room and workroom. Close to a wide window there was a large table upon which were disposed many sheets of music manuscript, some of which had already been written upon, while a further quantity of unused paper was ready waiting, and it was evident that actual work was in progress. Along one wall was a commodious couch upon which an old friend of ours was seated, and who rose upon our entrance. He was presented to Roger as Franz Joseph, and then resumed his seat. What instantly attracted the attention of our young lad was Franz's companions. For upon the couch there was our undoubted old acquaintance, the Puma, with whom Franz Joseph was now playing,
While upon the arm of the couch was to be seen the little grey sparrow, who was industriously employed exercising his lungs in a vast deal of twittering. "You've met before, it's plain to see," said Peter Litch, for the bird had at once flown to perch upon Roger's outstretched finger. "We asked Peter what the pair was doing here in his house. Why," said he, "I was at their home one day, and witnessed their amusing capers. While I was doing so, some music ran through my head that exactly fitted their antics. I thought it was rather too good to miss, and so I borrowed the pair of them from Radiant Wing, so that I could have them on the premises here, and watch them at my leisure. He has very kindly given me a sort of indefinite lease upon them. Their performances are never exactly the same. I expect you know, Roger, that Radiant Wing is curator-in-chief and friend-at-large to them, acting by special commission for his two friends on Earth, who between them are the particular friends of these two imps of mischief. I was at work on that music when you arrived." "Does that mean that we have seriously interrupted you?" asked Truth. "By no means, dear lady," answered Peter. "When I said I had something for you, I was referring to this very piece of music. The piano version is already completed. I thought perhaps you would like to have it. What I'm working on now is the orchestral arrangement, which I believe will be decidedly effective. It will differ only slightly from the piano version. Fuller, and with a few more frills and so on." "Is Roger interested in this sort of thing?"
"Yes, very. I played the scherzo you wrote for me, on the organ, The Sphere, you know, and he was full of delight, and questions. That's one of the reasons for our present call, apart from wishing him to meet you. He doesn't suspect, at least I don't think he does, who you are, though Monsignor did caution him to look for surprises. He's had one already with the two pets. I'm sure he doesn't know who France is either. Well, you know, my dear, we have changed a little since we came here. Roger was amusing himself with France, the puma, and the bird, and was oblivious to our conversation. Presently Ruth called to him. Roger, dear, said she, you remember the piece I played for you at the church? Peter has written another for me. Roger joined us at the table, and was now gazing very earnestly from Peter Lidge to a bust standing upon a side table. It was of a man in middle age, and wearing a neatly trimmed beard. Peter was amused at Roger's obvious attempt to match the two. "You feel you can trace some relationship, Roger?" queried Peter. "You are perfectly correct. That was how I looked when I was on Earth. It's not vanity that leads me to keep that bust here, but solely the beauty of the workmanship. It was an exquisitely wrought piece of sculpture. It was done by someone who knew me as I was, and preferred to model it on those lines," Peter continued. "Do you think I've improved, Roger?"
"My goodness, sir," answered Roger, "that's an awkward question. If I say yes, it would imply there was room for improvement. If I say no, you haven't improved. Oh, heavens." The boy was lost in confusion, and there was a burst of laughter from the rest of us, not the least from Peter himself. He was, of course, now in his prime of life, in precisely the same way as Franz had reverted to a similar period of external youthfulness. Roger was very apologetic for his seeming curiosity, but he could not resist asking Peter what was contained in the many large volumes that were to be seen upon the shelves. To those unacquainted with the manuscript of orchestral scores, the volumes might have an unusual appearance in their size. It was explained that they constituted the works of our present host. Roger was astounded at their enormous quantity. "There is nothing remarkable about that, my dear friend," said Peter. "You see, it's some considerable time since I first came here to live, and I've not exactly been idle in the meantime. It amuses us greatly when we hear the announcement made on Earth before a broadcast performance, that this is the last work composedly so and so." "The last work?" "Naturally, one knows what is meant, but it sounds so funny to us, especially when one glances at those shelves. Is it positively believed, I wonder, that once we have left the Earth, we've stopped composing?" I hastened to assure him it was so. "That is why they put up statues and monuments to us, my dear friend," said Franz Joseph. "They think we are finished and done for, not a note left in us.
And now they are perfectly certain they know what was in our minds when we wrote any piece, large or small. If any of us had given the plain reason, to keep off starvation, they wouldn't have approved of that. Not nearly mystic enough. Ah, well. This is the life. What do you say, my friends? There was no need to affirm our complete agreement. Now, Peter, Franz added, play your new piece. I should like to hear it again myself. Peter went across to a grand piano standing in a corner, a handsome instrument, and commenced to play. I will not essay the impossible by attempting to describe what our friend played. To give a description of any piece of music in mere words is a useless and fruitless task, as it conveys to the reader precisely nothing. The most that can be done is to give a series of musical technicalities and details which in the end indicate precious little. Suffice it that the music that was played followed in broad outline the physical movements of the tupets, the bird and the puma, in the amusing performance we witnessed when we called upon Radiant Wing. The music rose and fell, as it were, in imitation, or emulation, of what was taking place between the two, together with the many sudden twists and turns, first this way, then that way. Beyond this, it is not feasible to go, in words, except that the piece was in every respect a scherzo, as might be rightly supposed from the nature of its program. At the end of the playing, Ruth expressed her delight, as did we all, especially Franz, who paid its composer the very sincere tribute of a brother artist. Now about the orchestral arrangement, said Ruth. When shall we be able to hear that? Very shortly, I hope, Peter replied. It will be included in a program of other works, of course. Shall I let you know? Most certainly, please. Roger had been standing with his back to the bookshelves while the music was being played. Now he turned, and was to be observed reading the titles upon the volumes. Ruth and I joined him, feeling that at any moment he would make an interesting discovery. The works were arranged in orderly manner according to their nature, with all the compositions written while Peter was on earth grouped together. He ran his forefinger along the titles, naming them over to himself. Suite in G, he read, Symphony No. 6, when Peter said, that work is always announced as the last work the composer wrote. That is the line of demarcation, Roger, between what I wrote on earth and what I have done since. It was plain to see that the latter heavily outweighed the former by innumerable volumes. Yet this is nothing, he continued, it is the same with all of us. Take Franz Joseph, there. He has written volumes and volumes of music. Opus numbers run into four figures here, Roger, and if we hadn't wonderful memories, we should be at a loss to know how much we had actually composed. Is it easier to compose music here or on earth? Asked Roger. Oh, here. Without a shadow of doubt. Consider how free we are from everything that might be and so often was a hindrance. Franz mentioned starvation, for instance. Call it plain hunger in this case, and all that it means. In other words, caring for the necessary bodily wants. We're entirely free of that. Public apathy, there's something else that's thankfully missing here. Difficulty of getting one's works heard or acknowledged. No trouble about that either here. Somewhere pleasant to live, this little place is an example. Franz lives in a delightful house where he is as happy as the day is long, and it's a very long day here, Roger, as I expect you've noticed. Now what else is there? No music critics, said Franz with a chuckle, though fortunately for me I did not suffer much from those peculiar people. Not, I would have you understand, that my music was so perfect, but because I lived at a period when musical criticism was not the subject for every ignoramus who thinks he knows something about music, as I believe is the custom now on earth. Your native land was very kind to me, my friends, and still is, he said, addressing the three of us by the bookshelves. And to me, too, said Peter, though they will look on us as dead. Only think what a sensation we should cause, my dear Franz, if we could collect the rest. And go marching upon some concert platform on earth, other after the other, or arm in arm. There would be a riot. Think of the money we should make, or somebody would make out of us. The second is more likely, exclaimed Franz. Then the critics would begin operations. They would cut our symphonies and things into small pieces, and put them under the musical microscope, show us exactly where we went wrong, what we ought to have done, and what we were thinking about when we wrote them. And nobody would be able to understand a word any of them said, least of all themselves.